inequality killing us all? We're in a situation where our health is deteriorating through no fault of our own as individuals. The fault is our collective efforts as a society. We spend close to half the world's health care bill, yet we have perhaps 100 million people who are either uninsured or lack sufficient health care insurance. This is crazy.
That's Stephen Bezruchka, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Stephen Bezruchka. Inequality kills us all. In the 1950s, the United States had among the lowest mortality rates and highest life expectancy in the world. Today, other rich nations and quite a number of poor ones have better health outcomes than Americans. Why? How can the U.S., probably the wealthiest country in history, do so poorly? Starting with Reagan in the 1980s and the fervent embrace of neoliberal economics by the ruling class, we've seen an overall decline in health and life expectancy, along with huge gaps in income. The causes of our inequality and subsequent poor health indices are political. Thus, remedies must also be political. As Dr. Bezruchka says, our future work needs to focus on exposing ways in which rampant social injustice affects not just our economic well-being, but also our prospects for a healthy life. Inequality, he says, kills. Our guest today is Dr. Stephen Bezruchka. He's on the faculty of the Department of Global Health and the Department of Health Services at the University of Washington. He worked for many years as an emergency physician in Seattle. He's the author of Inequality Kills Us All. He spoke in Seattle in mid-March at an event organized by Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility. And now, Stephen Bezruchka.
So what should we consider as being vital to our lives? Yeah, I think it's a good question. The key word is vital. If you go to a doctor with a problem, very likely she or her assistant will measure your vital signs, blood pressure, pulse, temperature, a few others, to get a sense of how vital you are. That is, how alive you are. When I worked as an emergency physician and someone came to the ER, one of the first steps in assessing how critical that person's problem was to take vital signs. If they were talking sense, had a normal pulse and blood pressure, I could take my time getting to him or her. But if she was not rousable, had a blood pressure of 60 over 40, and a weak pulse, I'd be there in a heartbeat. Can't live very long if your vital signs suggest the Grim Reaper is coming. So these days you can get devices, including smartwatches, to measure your vital signs. I'm told an Apple Watch can call 911 if it thinks your vital signs are critical, such as in a car crash. So apparently now it's a common issue with dispatchers receiving emergency calls from skiers who fall on the snow slope and the watch can't distinguish that from an automobile collision. So being alive or dead is vital to an individual person. What about a country or state or city? What should the vital measurement be there? Like that of an individual person, it should be how alive or dead that population is. That must be the most important measure made in that geographical area. How many are alive? And for those that aren't, how old were they when they died? And I'm sure you out there would rather be alive than dead. So such measurements for a society are easy to obtain. Everybody knows their birth date, which is recorded by the state. And you don't know your date of death yet, but when that happens, it will be recorded. So a town, city, state, or nation can compile these records to come up with a measure called life expectancy, namely the average length of life if mortality rates didn't change. That indicator, a reflection of the health of the people in that society, must be the most important vital sign. So how alive are Americans? Well, we're not very alive if And that is, we don't live very long if the standard is comparing how we're doing in the past or compared to other countries today. That should be the biggest concern in the United States. More important than surveillance balloons in the sky or inflation or bank collapses or lifestyles of the rich and famous. A federal agency, the National Center for Vital Statistics, a branch of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in the Department of Health and Human Services, produced a report in December 2022 pointing out that our life expectancy in 2021 was 76.4 years, which had dropped from 77 years in 2020. There was no mention of the continuing decline in American life expectancy over the last few years, and no mention of comparisons with other nations. Other media sources looking at past reports provide that information. They said our life expectancy was now what it was in 1996, and the decline from 2019 to 2021 was bigger than any drop in the last 100 years. We should be very concerned, but we're not. Besides recognizing we're dying younger than before, we need to ask why. A quick answer is our over 1.1 million deaths from COVID-19, considerably more than any other nation. But our lifespan has not been increasing or was declining since 2015, well before SARS-CoV-2 struck. Another answer found in the media comes from our stratospheric rise in drug overdose deaths. I'll speak more to this later, but point out that for neither COVID nor drug overdose deaths is the why question asked. So what should our health outcomes be for the richest and most powerful nation in world history that spends half of the world's healthcare bill? How are other nations doing? Well, people in all the other rich nations live longer lives. According to the United Nations, or even our Central Intelligence Agency, who tally health outcomes for countries, quite a few poorer nations have better health. They include Chile, Thailand, Slovenia, and the Czech Republic, among many others. Given the choice, I'd rather live a longer life than a shorter, sicker one. The longest-lived country since 1978 has been Japan. They live about 8 years longer than we do. To grasp the significance of those 8 years, if we eradicated our three leading killers in America, heart disease, cancer, and COVID, we'd be close to Japan's health. Japan's health is so much better than ours that if we got rid of our three greatest causes of death, we would only be close to, but not equaling, Japan's life expectancy. Whenever the media reports that American life expectancy as being lower than that of other nations, they don't present what those differences mean in years, as I have. It must be healthy behaviors that the Japanese engage in that we don't, right? The sushi they eat. In one of Japan's healthiest prefectures, Okinawa, the mainstay meal consists of pork fat and noodles. Visiting the market there, I found huge slabs of pork fat that people buy along with various flavored cans of Spam. It's a delicacy there. And from personal experience, I can verify this is what they eat. The secret? They don't eat too much. Another discovery is that more than three times the proportion of men smoke cigarettes in Japan than in America. Those who've been to Japan can attest to the large numbers of male smokers everywhere. There are other more important factors than bad health habits, such as eating pork fat or smoking cigarettes, that impacts how long you live. Let's explore what the health department in our healthiest state, Hawaii, writes as most important in impacting health. They use a mountainside metaphor, which people there can relate to. There's a high ridge on the mountain that leads to a cascading waterfall streaming to a river flowing into the ocean. Their graphic distinguishes Mukai, or to the ocean, or downstream effects on health, from Mauka, or upstream, or to the sky, or root causes affecting health. Where the river enters the ocean on are the behaviors such as smoking and physical activity on one side. On the other side is health care. The health department in Hawaii puts health care far downstream, much less important than what lies above. Where the waterfall drops, they list what are the social determinants of health, namely racism, poverty, pollution, income, and others that are more important than health care or behaviors. Then above that, socioeconomic conditions, and finally the most important is political context and governance. Our healthiest state considers politics as the most important factor impacting health. What does that mean? Well, in my quest to understand what makes a society healthy, after much research, I settled on two factors as being most important. One is the amount of economic inequality in a population, and the other is the attention given to early life there. These two are inherently political. That is, they're under our control through the democratic process that exists in the United States. We can do something about our dying young. But first we need to know that our lives are not as long or healthy as they could be for reasons that go beyond personal behaviors such as smoking, diet, and exercise. So in our world of misinformation, disinformation, false facts, and deep fakes, how do we come to know something is true? I used to think medical care and personal behaviors mattered most for health. That is why I became a medical doctor. I was a vegetarian for years. Then I came across the data I've shared about Japan and cigarette smoking there. I couldn't resolve those findings. I had to understand what was going on and to change my mind. I discovered that changing your mind is one of the best ways of discovering whether you still have a mind or not. I've had to think critically and make many changes. So I went to public health school with my question of what makes a population healthy. The Johns Hopkins School of Hygiene and Public Health, as it was called then in 1992, was the first and still the biggest public health school in the world. There, I learned that social and political factors mattered most for making a society healthy. Next, I came across studies linking income inequality and health. There are now some 500 or so studies linking economic inequality with health outcomes. They fit the criterion to say inequality causes worse health. A large part of my book, Inequality Kills Us All, addresses the key role of economic inequality in producing worse health. Take mass shootings, which are almost a daily occurrence in America. The Secret Service released a report this year addressing the issue. They talked about how shooters experienced stressful life events, had histories of aggressive behaviors, and were retaliating for perceived wrongs in their lives. Nowhere was U.S. inequality mentioned. Studies demonstrate that mass shootings occur where there is high income inequality and the presence of great wealth. Living in such places is very stressful and might make some act out aggressively and try to right wrongs they had experienced. So inequality is a root cause of so many problems that are not addressed in this country. Instead, we are told it's a few bad apples, instead of recognizing the whole orchard is rotten. The other critical discovery was that early life lasts a lifetime. As we go from the erection to the resurrection, the first 1,000 days after conception are roughly when half of our health as adults is programmed. During the first 9 months of that you spend in the womb, the fertilized ovum, now called a zygote, divides 42 times to produce a newborn. There are only 5 more cycles of division to produce you out there listening to me. Cell division is a very sensitive time when environmental and emotional factors can affect the process. That makes the first 9 months a critical period in shaping what kind of health happens to the resulting adult. By the time you're blowing out 2 candles on your second birthday cake, many of the cards in your adult health deck have already been dealt. So healthier societies privilege those 1,000 days. Consider having paid time off after you deliver a baby. Only 2 countries in the world with populations over 1 million do not have a national policy of paid maternity leave. One is, of course, the United States, and the other is Papua New Guinea, half of a big island north of Australia. So our stingy early life conditions end up sacrificing our health. I'll go into that later as well. Just keep in mind 2 thoughts. One is how important political choices are that decide who gets what share of the economic pie. That's the inequality we produce in America. And the second is how early life is structured here. Let's go back to measuring vital signs. So what are normal vital signs? When you see a healthcare worker who measures yours, there are ranges for what is acceptable or normal. Your blood pressure may be 120 over 80 or 100 over 60, but not 220 over 150 or 60 over 40. The last two are not normal. What is normal for the vital signs of a nation? They should be what the healthiest nation has. I mentioned that each rich nation tallies birth and death records that are reported, and they're good estimates for other countries that don't record vital events. When I was a medical student at Stanford University in the early 1970s, in a page of notes that I wrote, in 1951-53, the United States had the lowest maternal mortality of all nations. There were 67 deaths per 100,000 live births. I then wrote that by 1966, quite a few nations had achieved lower deaths of women in childbirth than America did. Same was true for infant mortality and life expectancy. We did well in the early 1950s, but other countries outpaced the U.S. in improving health over the next 15 years. Today, the lowest number, under 2 maternal deaths, occurs in a few countries, while for the United States, our death rate is more than 10 times higher than the best. And if you're an African-American mother, the number is about what it was for the entire country in the early 1950s, over 60 deaths per 100,000 births. Think of that. What we achieved in the early 1950s for childbirth-related deaths is still what African-American mothers face today. Childbirth deaths in America are rising in contrast to what is happening in almost all other nations, which makes the news today. They tell stories of famous black mothers who almost died during pregnancy. Receiving poor medical care is typically the reason presented, but that is only part of the answer. The stress of racism is a major cause too. The same is true to other measures of deaths, such as in infancy or adulthood. Namely, African Americans do not achieve the levels of white Americans. A typical response relates to the finding that black Americans do not have the educational achievements of whites. They need to graduate from college. But the evidence doesn't back that up. Look at infant mortality rates, namely how many children born die in their first year of life. Some 50 nations have lower rates of death than the United States. I often have my students do a calculation of how many infants die every day in America that wouldn't if we have Japan's, Slovenia's, or Norway's low rate, which are all below 2 deaths per 1,000 births. The U.S. number is about 5.5. Calculation shows that about 35 infants die every day in America that wouldn't if we had what I would call a normal infant death rate. Consider the number of deaths from police killings here that make the news. horrible tragedies such as Tyree Nichols in Memphis, an African-American who was killed by six black police during a traffic stop in January. The estimates of such headlines, such killings, number over 1,000 a year, or 3 a day. These make the headlines, as they should, but not the 35 infants every day. The scenario is like going into a newborn nursery and lining up 35 infants, then either beating or shooting them to death, then return the next day and do it again and again. If we knew about it, would we tolerate this carnage? I hope not. Let's further explore infant deaths in the United States. There was a full-page story in the February 19th, 2023 issue of the New York Times, and it presented the data I'm reviewing here. Exploring the role of family income for white mothers, the richer your household is, the lower the infant deaths. But this is not true for black mothers. They point out that the richest black women have infant deaths at the same level as the poorest white mothers. Same is true for education. Namely, college-educated black mothers have the highest rate of infant deaths across all other racialized groups. Same is true for deaths of black women from childbirth-related causes. Getting a college degree is not the solution for dealing with racism in America. I want to put all this together with my two main points about. The title of my book is Inequality Kills Us All, COVID-19's Health Lessons for the World. Becoming a rich African-American mother is not going to solve the problem. Income or wealth inequality is killing us all. We live shorter lives because we're in a country whose goal is to make the rich richer than they ever dream possible. I know you say that's not what you're doing. Let's face the reality. Let's explore our nation's economics. The national debt is growing while facing a ceiling. We want to raise the debt ceiling. What's the alternative to taking on more debt? Let's make it personal. You have a loan taken out to pay for your education, something that's uniquely American. In other rich countries, higher education is mostly free, but not in America. Student debt is huge here. You can either borrow more money and increase your debt, or you can cut down your expenses, or you can make more money. What about a country that wants to have more money? How does a country make more money? Raise taxes. That's the same as making money at the national level. While a large proportion of the public feel the rich should pay more taxes, even though President Biden paid lip service to this in his State of the Union address and in the proposed budget, Congress is unlikely to do this. Why? Well, the rich and powerful control the political process in this country. Corporations have the right to contribute as much money as they want to control politicians. This resulted from the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision in 2010. We have the best democracy money can buy, or the best plutocracy money can buy. Plutocracy is a fancy word for rule by the rich. So it doesn't look like taxes will be raised. Recall how in the early 1950s we had the best mortality outcomes among all nations. Back then, we had very progressive taxation. The richest earners paid big taxes. The highest marginal tax rate then was 91%. If you were one of the top earners and made an extra dollar, you would get 9 cents and the rest would go to the government. Nobody protested. This is unfair. Today, the highest marginal tax rate is in the mid-30% range. If we take combined federal, state, and local taxes of all kinds, the richest 400 Americans pay the lowest tax rate of anybody, lower than any other group, including the bottom half of Americans. I hope you don't think this is fair, but it won't change without people power. Don't raise taxes as our agenda. Instead, increase the national debt. But in the 1950s, we had no national debt. It didn't begin until the rise of neoliberal economics in the late 1970s. And taking on more debt happens no matter which party is in power in D.C. When does it make sense to take on more debt? Getting a loan to buy a house makes sense if you can pay off the loan. Recall how banks made irresponsible loans for people to buy houses in the 1990s that borrowers had no chance of paying back. This led to the banking crisis of 2007 and 8. Then we bailed out the banks while homes were foreclosed. None of the bankers went to jail for this heinous crime. Instead, they received lavish bonuses from the money we gave to the banks to bail them out. The situation is even more extreme today. We didn't learn our lesson. So why is the United States taking on more debt now? We have a huge military-industrial complex that wants more and more federal money. And we're sending hundreds of billions of dollars to Ukraine. And we continue to lavish federal subsidies for rich corporations. These resources don't go to you or me. The other way out of our conundrum is to cut expenses. That is also what we're doing. Whatever federal and state benefits were available to help us through the COVID-19 pandemic have been cut. In Europe, they call such belt-tightening austerity. Here, one speaks of budgetary restraint. The government is supposed to cut expenses. But which expenses? Not those that go to the rich and powerful, mostly corporations. That's where the almost $1 trillion we dole out to the military-industrial complex go, instead of funding low-cost housing or Medicaid or Social Security or funding for national parks or education. That is what goes on today. This is bad news. We're in a situation where our health is deteriorating through no fault of our own as individuals. Recall how personal health-related behaviors are not to blame. The fault is our collective efforts as a society, which is still the richest and most powerful nation in world history. Together, we're not doing what needs to be done. How is inequality killing us all? All of us. Don't some escape? Consider that the healthiest people on the planet are never in the U.S. Many notables die before reaching age 60, such as Steve Jobs or Michael Jackson or Elvis or so many others. And the oldest old person at any one time is never in America. So how does inequality kill all of us? Well, income and wealth inequality produce huge amounts of stress. We're constantly making comparisons with others who have more than we do. They look better on social media. They have more followers. Their incomes are higher. They drive bigger, newer cars than you and I, and they live in McMansions. This makes you feel bad about yourself since you don't look so good. That's right. We blame ourselves for not achieving the American dream and becoming rich. Think of all the efforts made with selfie surgery apps, diet and weight loss programs, mindfulness advice, and the other ways we cope with stress from consuming 3/4 of the entire world's opioids. Sunday New York Times for February 26th this year had the opinion section devoted entirely to drug use in America, as well as the overdose crisis. More than 100,000 deaths a year come from so-called illicit drug use, and they point out how this is greater than at any point in U.S. history. Among root causes, they said, needed to be addressed were the need for more housing options, better food security, and access to basic medical care. They preached for harm reduction, such as